rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome to our program. Coming up on the program today, are we going to see a repeat of the Republican Great Depression? Looks like maybe the new chairman of the Fed is concerned about that. Jeffrey Feldman from the Frame Shop is Open is going to be joining us in the next hour. And how much more damage will these folks who call themselves conservatives, I wouldn't call them so, in any case, do before Americans wake up? We shall see. Our quote for the day, government is not a reason. This is from George Washington. Government is not reason. It is not eloquence. It is a force. Like fire, a troublesome servant and a fearful master. Never for a moment should it be left to irresponsible action. David Tebow with CNS News is with us, cnsnews.com, the old conservative news service. So you changed your name to, is it?
Spit it out, Tom.
Cybercast News Service, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Occasionally I confuse that with some other word that's similar to it. David Tebow, I'm wondering how long are conservatives going to live in the fantasy of a liberal media?
Well, I don't know quite what fantasy you're talking about. The liberal media is a reality to a large extent. There are slices of it that tend to be conservative, but do you really believe that the vast majority of the media is not sort of in lockstep with the New York Times and the Washington Post and liberal mindset?
Well, first of all, I would consider the New York Times and the Washington Post to be part of that. For example, during a debate on health care reform, this a couple of years ago, the New York Times ran stories persistently in favor of managed competition, a program which would have been profitable to major health care corporations. Proposals like the Canadian single-payer program were completely ignored by the New York Times. Why? Four members of the Times Board of Directors are also directors of major insurance companies. Two are directors of pharmaceutical companies. The executive producer of ABC's top-rated news show, 2020, Victor Neufeld, repeatedly rejected several promising stories on nuclear power hazards. Why? Well, his wife is a prominent spokesman for the nuclear and chemical industries. Might have something to do with it. Walter Annenberg, owner of the Philadelphia Inquirer, uses his paper to attack a candidate who opposed action that would have benefited the stockholders of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Why? Well, he's the single largest stockholder of that railroad. Rupert Murdoch's New York Post endorsed President Carter in the crucial New York presidential primary, contributing to his victory. Why? 2 days earlier, Murdoch had lunched with Carter, convincing him to lean on the Export-Import Bank of the United States to give him a taxpayer-subsidized loan of $290 million. I mean, it's all about money. It's all about corporations. Tell me any major media in the United States that's not run by a huge multinational corporation.
I'll grant you that money is the first priority of anybody in broadcasting or anybody in business.
And it shouldn't be that way, David.
Well, once you get past the money, then the ideology, the agenda, kicks in. And if you're not talking about money, then you've got to admit, Tom, that there is a liberal bias, that the vast majority of the establishment media in the United States has a liberal mindset left over from the 1960s.
Well, if you're talking about Goldberg's book, I mean, it's been thoroughly discredited. The Virginia Commonwealth did this very good study. 141 journalists and bureau chiefs, including ABC, Associated Press, Bloomberg, CNN, Knight Ridder, LA Times, NBC News, New York Times, Reuters, Time, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Washington Times. Question, on social issues, how would you characterize your political orientation? Left, 30%. Right, 9%. That's what you're saying. On economic issues, how would you characterize your political orientation? Left, 11%. Right, 19%. So,
well,
you know, I and all of them, virtually all of them, well over 90%, said that they worked very hard not to let their political orientation spill into their reporting.
Tom, I think, for every anecdote that you cite...
That's not an anecdote, it's a study.
The organization that I work for does careful research and has been doing so for more than 15 years and has literally volumes of documented evidence of liberal bias. So
okay, David Tebow with CNS News. Let's talk about the Sunday talk shows.
Return.
Let's talk about the Sunday talk shows, for example. Here we find from 1997 to 2005, the last study that was done, and this is a seven-year period.
Are you going to mention George Stephanopoulos and Tim Russert in this discussion?
This This includes, let's see, this week, yeah, this week.
You mean
ABC's This Week, CBS's Face the Nation.
Those who work for Moynihan and Cuomo.
Exactly. ABC's This Week, that's Stephanopoulos, CBS's Face the Nation, and NBC's Meet the Press. We look at those three shows during the last 7 years. If you look at the guests on those programs, in Bush's first term, that's from 2001 to 2004, 2005, Republicans or conservatives held a dramatic advantage, outnumbering Democratic progressive guests by 58% to 42%.
Well, they run the government, Tom. They run the House, the Senate, and the White House.
And so it is the obligation of people who are reporting the news only to put the people in power on television. Is that what you're suggesting, David Tebow? That's not democracy. That's dictatorship.
Tom, just because there's a larger percentage of Republicans appearing on these shows doesn't mean that these interviews are favorable. Far from it.
In every year examined by the study, 1997 to 2005, more panels tilted right than tilted left. In some years, there were two, three, or even four times as many right-tilted panels.
Are you saying tilted right simply because of the number of guests that were Republican?
We're talking, in this case...
What about hostile interviews?
Well, even with a hostile interview, the person gets an opportunity to put their point out. I mean, I have you on, you're putting your point out.
But if George Stephanopoulos is doing the Democratic talking points, you don't need somebody from the Democratic Party, do you?
If George Stephanopoulos was doing the Democratic talking points, I wish he would. What I'm seeing is just, you know, tell me, for example, David Tebow of CNSNews.com, tell me any major media outlet, any major network media outlet, that in the run-up to the war, when you had in the run-up to the war in Iraq, in the fall of 2002, the spring of 2003, when we had the largest outpouring of people in demonstrating against a war in the history of the world, any major media outlet that was sharing the story about why we shouldn't go to war, at least 50% of the time, since more than 55% of Americans in the poll that was done 4 days before Bush started bombing showed 55% of Americans were still opposed to invading Iraq. So where was that 55% reflecting their point of view in the media? It didn't exist.
Are you saying that there was no attention to the anti-war sentiment in the United States before the invasion of Iraq?
The ratio of pro-war versus anti-war guests and the mainstream media, which includes CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and MSNBC, and Fox, pro-war versus anti-war, was something on the order of 440 or more pro-war guests during that two-month period prior to that versus seven anti-war guests.
Well,
yes,
I won't argue
what I'm saying.
The statistics that you just cited. But again, you're assuming that just because the number of guests might be from the military and that number is a larger percentage than the people who would be opposed against the war, to assume, Tom, that represents a favorable story for going to war, I think is a faulty assumption.
David, we're talking with David Tebow of CNSNews.com. I just don't get it how you can continue to believe that there's a liberal media out there. I mean, there is a liberal media. You're talking to me right now.
But
there's not a whole bunch of us.
Are you saying that we get enough of a representation in the establishment media about the good that is happening in Iraq today?
Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about, David. I don't know how old you are, but I remember when I was growing up as a kid in Michigan, we had the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. They both came out of Detroit. They were both statewide papers. The Detroit News was the labor paper. They had a labor section. The Detroit Free Press was the business paper. It had a business section. The Detroit News no longer exists. I don't know of, frankly, any newspaper in the United States that still has a labor section. Do you?
No. I mean, I...
So know, where is the voice of labor? The number of people who own businesses in the United States is infinitesimal compared to the vast majority of people who are blue-collar workers in this country, and yet newspapers are not even devoting a section to them. Could that have something to do with the massive consolidation of newspapers that occurred when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and when that really picked up speed when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 1996?
It has to do with making money, Tom, which we both agree is the first...
I'd say it has to do with monopoly. I'd say it has to do with abuse of democratic process.
It has to do with making money. I mean,
sure. And making money at the expense of democracy.
Well, you can call it whatever you want. I'll call it capitalism, and they have the right to do that.
So you're saying
if
that there isn't a liberal media.
They lack a fiduciary responsibility. You know, that's what they're in business to do, is to make money and do better than the competition.
In the context of our society, that's why we have rules for the game of business.
We have rules in the game of business, Tom, but
you can make money selling poison,
David. In Venezuela and Cuba.
You can make money simply selling poison and selling it to people as candy, and you can make a lot of money at that. But we as a society say you can't do that. There are certain rules.
You're arguing for socialism, Tom.
I am arguing for regulated capitalism, David. I am absolutely in favor of capitalism. There's no such thing as a free market, David.
Oh, there is a free market. It happens in spite of individuals like yourself.
Interesting conversation. David Thibault, CNSNews.com. Thanks for being with us, David.
You have a good afternoon.
You too, David. 16
Bye.
Minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Not long ago in America, a nation's heartbeat throbbed. United, not divided. Families only needed one job. Folks could afford a baseball game, hot dog and a beer. Vacation in the summer. Had a few new clothes each year. Big MacDonald had a farm. Then he opened a burger joint. We've drowned in fat ever since. Till there really ain't no point. Tipped beyond measure. We keep coming back for more. Now the justice scale lies broken. All over the global floor.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Our bumper music today, by the way, all day. All bumper music today is from an album called Homeless in America. You can find more information about it at Freedom Tracks, freedomtracks.com. 22 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in, register your thoughts on this and other issues. We're going to get into some of the economic issues of the day. We got so much that we're going to cover today. It's going to be a great day. I got to tell you, just think tanks, just looking at think tanks, the number of right-wing think tanks out there, 8,014. Number of liberal or left-wing think tanks, 1,632. And the unpublicized donations to the three conservative think tanks which shaped U.S. public opinion by serving as primary sources for more than 8,000 major media stories. You know, when you see an article in the paper, it says, the Cato Institute today said, blah, 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 blah. Over $100 million spent to make that happen. $100 million. Right-wing think tanks. Mark in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling the program.
Hey, Tom, we really miss you here in Vermont. How are you doing?
I really miss Vermont, Mark, but I'm going to get back there. I'm going to get back there this summer.
Oh, good. I just wanted to comment on the last guest you have. I'm not sure what universe this guy is from, but I recall all too well the softball questions lobbed to military personnel by the likes of Katie Couric of the Today Show. You know, are we going to, how much of a victory are we going to have in Iraq and all of this nonsense? You know, and I see the results of not only a coward media on a daily basis, but also a coward political party, read Democrats, who can't even sign on to a censure resolution.
Well, not to mention the Republicans. I mean, increasingly the Republicans are the party of cowardice as well. They're unwilling to go against their own president, even when he violates their fundamental principles. I mean, they're going to raise the debt ceiling now to almost $8 trillion. They'll take it up to like 7.965 or something so they can say, well, it's still only 7 and change. But, you know, really they're taking it up to $8 trillion. This is a guy who has added $3 trillion to the U.S. debt since he's been president.
So much for responsibility.
I mean, yeah. And you know, talking about holding an economy together with bubble gum and glue, that's $3 trillion. That's a mind-boggling amount of money that we handed him a credit card when he came into office, him and the Republicans, and said, okay, here's our credit card. You know, the Constitution gives the Congress, gives the House of Representatives the power to initiate spending, but the president has to sign it into law. And so we handed basically our credit card. That is, it's got our name on it, you and me. You and me, Mark, we're gonna have to pay for this thing. We're the ones who are ultimately signing this credit card bill. And we said, here's our credit card. Please be careful with it. And Bush ran up $3 trillion on our credit card. And then he looks around and he says, hey, look at how good the economy's doing. Look at all this. There's lots of spending going on. Yeah, $3 trillion on our credit card. And our kids are going to pay for it. This is nuts. So I'd say the real cowardice is not in the Democratic Party, because they frankly don't have the power to do anything right now. They don't control the House, the Senate, or the presidency. The real cowardice is in the Republican Party, which is not standing up for its own principles.
Right, right. Good point, Tom.
Yeah. So anyhow, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, and your guests, I swear to God, they all do it. They don't get it. You said media monopoly priorities are making money at the expense of democracy. And what was his response?
It's the free market.
No, he said it's capitalism. And, Tom, you're talking socialism. They
right.
do not get the difference between an economic system and a political system.
I know. It's a tragedy when folks don't. I mean, not just conservatives. It's
so
a tragedy
it's
when anybody doesn't understand the difference between an economic system and a political
but
system.
Lou Dobbs gets it, and he's trying to, more and more, he's talking about the democracy is superior to the economic system.
And Lou Dobbs is a Republican.
I know, but he's finally getting what
I know. I'm agreeing with you that he gets it, and I think it's wonderful that he gets it, and he's a Republican. It's like, this is not something that is just an idea of the left. This isn't some liberal idea or even some big D Democratic idea. This is classical economics. It goes back to Jesuit de Tracy in 1784.
This is the Rosetta Stone. If we can expose this conflation, which undergirds their whole philosophy that
yeah.
democracy is capitalism. Once we expose this, it falls apart.
Yeah, in fact, not only is democracy not capitalism, but the country that is most aggressively embracing capitalism right now in the world is China, exactly, a communist dictatorship. And they are not letting up on their dictatorship. Instead, what they're doing is they're saying to capitalists, like, you know, Google and whatnot, you want to do business with us? You've got to participate with us in the oppression of the people.
Exactly. It's just, you
know, it's got nothing to do with democracy. It's got
yeah.
to do with making money.
But the whole con talking points talk like this, that when you talk about democracy, they really see that as socialism.
Yeah, yeah. And it's
yeah, I just wanted to point it out, because it's every con I talk to, that comes out of their mouth.
I know. And well, they've been well-programmed. I mean, they've had all these years of millionaire right-wing talk show hosts like Limbaugh trying to feed this stuff to them, and they apparently weren't paying attention during civics class in high school, or maybe they never took one. Who knows? Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Sing a song of taxes, working class cancer sore, be in Boston Harbor, Revolutionary War, of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score. Sing a song of taxes in the presidential pew. Throw in grease senators and corrupt congressmen in the crew.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Yes. 21% of Americans say that cheating on your wife is acceptable behavior. 19% of Americans support Dick Cheney. 34% of Americans believe that the U.S. government is in contact with space aliens. Excuse me. 38% of Americans think the United States is in contact with space aliens. 36% of Americans support George W. Bush. I mean, this is getting really spooky. Dick Cheney, 18 points. Yeah, I'm getting redundant here. Dick Cheney is 7 points behind corporal punishment in schools. More people agree with corporal punishment in schools than agree with Dick Cheney and his policies as Vice President of the United States. It is downright spooky out there. Alan in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I am just great, but I'll get better, Alan. What's on your mind today?
Well, your previous caller kind of stole my thunder, so I'm gonna change gears to just a little bit, ask you a single question. In my battles that I have with my conservative friends, I seem to have made some headway with the healthcare argument. But if you would, you know, they all kind of say, you know, it's just socialism. And socialism, the government owns everything. Explain to me, if you would, what the difference is, and I agree with you, but if you would explain the difference, why we should nationalize health and why we shouldn't nationalize certain other industries.
That's a really good question, Alan. Yeah. That's a really good question. Let's just go through it. First of all, there's a terrible problem with the word socialism, and that is that it has meant different things at different times in the past. When Karl Marx used the word socialism, he meant... And he used the word socialism in Das Kapital and in the Communist Manifesto, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was the name of the Soviet Union. What he meant was that the government would own all the means of supply and distribution. And that is not anything that I think any rational person is advocating, even in the so-called socialist countries like Chavez's Venezuela. You know, everybody acknowledges that private industry, private, you know, capitalism is a system that actually has some benefit and value to society, and when it works properly can have tremendous benefit and value to society. So then that raises the question. So today there are some people, like, for example, in Scandinavia and in Sweden, the Swedes, yeah, if you ask them, you know, some of them would say, yeah, we're a socialist nation. Others would say we're a socialist democratic nation. Others would say we're a democracy and we chose to be socialist. Others will say we're not socialist at all because the state doesn't own the means of control and distribution. We just have a really good healthcare system and really good retirement system. So, you know, it's like the danger of using that word, right, to start out with. Secondly, then you have to ask the question, okay, what is it appropriate for government to do? And which it gets to your question, Alan, about, you know, when, you know, should the government run the healthcare system? And if you go back to the Constitution even before that, to the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence talked about the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What are the essential core functions that government should do so that Americans... And I think you could generalize this to any government, but we're talking about America, so that Americans can have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think there's a pretty broad consensus that those things that have to do with literally our survival are things that are so precious and so valuable that, number one, they should not be put out to the highest or lowest bidder. They should not be put out for private profit. Nobody should be skimming money off the top of them. Just like, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said during World War II, he said there will be no war millionaires as a result of this war. And he was right. He had Harry Truman making sure that didn't happen. So even though the government wasn't making things, you know, but the point is, number one, there are some things that are so precious to us that we don't want corporations profiting off them because we want to administer them. And number two, we want the agencies that administer them to be responsible to we the people. So that includes things like our fire department, our police department, the construction of our roads, the construction and operation of our schools, the operation of our traffic system, our air traffic system we've decided is part of the commons. This is all called the commons. In many communities across America, and historically across most all communities, it's been water, sewage, and utilities, although increasingly utilities are privately owned, although there's still a lot of public utilities in the United States. They outnumber private utilities. And there are a lot of, an increasing number, not a lot, of private water systems, although they are outnumbered by public water systems. But by and large, we've said that these things that have to do with our ability to survive from day to day are the things that we would really rather have an agency answerable to us in the polling place running than a company where, like your health insurance company, you call them up and try to talk to the CEO of your health insurance company. Ain't never going to happen.
And I'll tell you, let me jump in here just
sure.
a second. The moral argument, you know, I'm right in line with, you know, as I talk to my friends, you know, it really is impacting. They get that part of it. What they come back with is an economic argument. Well, you know, if we nationalize health care, you know, we're going to have, you know, it's going to 40% taxes. It's going to, you know, it's going to greatly increase our taxes. My
right.
argument coming back is, and tell me if I'm right or wrong, we're already through Medicare, and I think there's a strong overall economic argument for Medicare, but aren't we already subsidizing the greater part of the cost for health care? We're already doing that, and it works. You know, how much, just from an economic standpoint, would it cost to fold in the rest of us to Medicare.
Right now, it is costing for every insured person in the United States, on average, when you include all their copayments, all their deductibles that they actually pay, the actual dollars spent, and the payments for the cost of the insurance, what they pay plus what their employer pays, every insured person in the United States is paying a little over $10,000 a year. It's around $10,500 and something. If we went, now let me just back up a little bit. Medicare operates with an overhead of about 2.5%, between 2 and 3% from year to year. So let's say 3%, worst case scenario. That means of every $100 that goes through Medicare, $3 sticks to the fingers of the administrators. Private health insurance companies in the United States say, oh, we can be more efficient than 3%. We can do it for 2%. And many of them can. The problem is, though, when you look at $100 going through a private health insurance company, the lowest in the United States is that $14 is sticking to their fingers. The highest is in the 30s. So between 15 and 30% of that $100, between $15 and $30 is sticking to the fingers of the health insurance companies. Well, wait a minute. I thought they were more efficient. Well, they are. Well, where's all that extra money going? It's going to pay for marketing. It's going to pay for advertising. It's going to pay for corporate overhead. It's going to pay for the corporate jet with the gold faucets. It's going to pay the $3 or $4 million a year salary for all the senior executives and the $100 million a year salary for the CEO. It's going to pay 10% of all the profits and dividends to the stockholders. I mean, that's where it's all going. So the bottom line is, if we were to shift from a private health care system like we have right now, which is the most expensive in the world, no country in the world spends even half as much as we do on a per capita basis. If we were to shift from a private health insurance company like or system like we have right now, which costs around $10,500 per person in the United States, to Medicare, just Medicare for everybody, we could, for the cost of a little over $5,000, about $5,100 per person per year, or per family per year, we could insure basically about 130 million, I think, families in the United States. We could insure every single person in America. It would cut our costs in half, and you would no longer have 40 million uninsured, because Medicare is so much less expensive than private insurance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, the ironic thing is that we're going to get there, but it's the corporations and, the chairman of GM come out and say, well, we kind of need to do this to stay competitive. That's ironically what may lead us there. But
well, it is. It really is.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's the biggie. To me, that's the biggie, and that's where we need to go.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alan, and thanks a lot for the call. And the point well made and well taken. I mean, there's more cost for health care than there is for steel in a car, and I think it was a big wake-up call for America when Toyota was talking about building an auto factory down in Alabama, and at the last minute they decided to build it in Canada instead because they didn't want to have to pay, $1,500, $2,000 per car for health insurance. And it just makes sense. And Canada's health insurance system costs about $4,000 per person, or per family across Canada. We're paying more than $10,000 per family, and we still have a bunch of us not covered. Dennis in Rochester, New York. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Not to beat a dead horse with your guest from earlier, because obviously you can't waste too much breath on a Republican-paid strategist who pats himself off as some kind of statistician.
This guy runs a right-wing conservative news service on the web.
Exactly. It's a think tank. He might as well be on Russia's show. It really just irritates me to no end to continue to hear this vast left-wing conspiracy that, the Republicans, we're victims of the media. They control the House, they control the Senate, they control the judiciary, and the presidency. They're running the economy into the ground. Yet they accuse everybody of coming after them, and that there's some conspiracy by the
leaders.
It's our fault. That's right.
Yeah, it's all our fault, Dennis.
That's right. And how deep and how in-depth and how hard-hitting was the coverage for all of Clinton's scandals? It was just as hard and just as mean and just as conspiracy-driven. You know what I mean?
I would say it was even more so.
The media goes after who's in charge. That's the bottom line.
Well, they should. They should, but I would submit to you, Dennis, that during the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton did not say to the people in the press room, "If you ask me a tough question, I'll never ask you a question again. I'll never allow you to ask a question again. I'll never call on you again, and I'll move you to the back row." Bill Clinton never did that. No president in the history of this country has ever done that, except George W. Bush, and that put a terrible chill on the American media. It's Soviet style. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Leroy lives in a cardboard box down by the Mission Bell, where saints refuse to go and the sinners wishing well. Forced to carry his own cross while we drive nails in his coffin. You might say it is routine, it happens far too often. Decorated soldier, veteran of the war, who would have thought that he would be among the sick and poor?
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Danny in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hey, Danny.
Hi, Tom. Your guest earlier mentioned liberal press spouting out only bad press out of Iraq. And a couple weeks ago, I heard an interview on NPR. And I can't remember what the journalist, what her name was, but when posed the question, what is your reaction to those who say the press only reports bad news out of Iraq? She said it was really frustrating. In quotes, she said, if 5 bombs went off in New York City today and 47 people were kidnapped from there today, you wouldn't be hearing stories of a school being painted. And that's going on every day. And that was my comment, Tom.
Yeah. Well, it's that's the nature of it. Danny, thanks a lot for the call, and you know your point is well taken. I mean, you know, it's one of the points that I think that these guys, you know, the Rumsfeld is making and whatnot, is, and nobody's talking about schools being painted. Yeah, you don't talk about schools being painted in New York. I mean, there was a school painted in Portland today. In all probability, I don't know anything about it, but because you know nobody died. I mean, the press is all about people slow down for train wrecks and or for car wrecks and for fist fights. I mean, that's what the press is all about, and that's not a bad thing. We want to know about the aberrations, not the normal functioning of society. We assume society is going to function well, and in fact, one of the ways that we measure whether society is not functioning well is by the number of aberrations, and that's part of why the press reports on them. Hey, Dick in Dayton, Ohio.
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Dick. What's on your mind?
Pleasure to talk. I was telling you, Screener, I don't have much time right now. I'm here at work at the Home Improvement, but I think you guys are doing a great job of promoting the liberal media. You do a good job, buddy.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a start.
You got my support. I'm going to keep sending letters and cards up to you, buddy.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Dick. Good to hear from you. Yeah. Kevin in Kanawha, New Jersey. Hey, Kevin.
Yeah. Kevin? Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could possibly comment and or maybe do some further research on with the Iraqi war, that in the beginning Saddam was threatening to convert, instead of using American dollars, was to use the euro.
Right.
And now it's been said that Iran is going to drop the dollar for oil and switch over to the euro, and possibly that's the reason why the present administration is ramping up all the comments and stuff that we might have to invade Iran, because we got to help prop up the dollar, because if people start to drop by the wayside and convert over to the euro and not the American dollar, the whole game is over.
You're right. Well, first of all, yes, Saddam did say that he was going to create an oil bourse, a trading floor, you know, kind of a New York Stock Exchange, as it were, of oil, or actually probably more like a Chicago Commodities Exchange, or the oil, you know, one of the oil exchanges in London. He was going to create one denominated in euros. And it's also true that a week or so before we invaded Iraq, he said, I'm not going to do that anymore. I promise. I will keep it only in dollars. Didn't do him any good. And it is true that Iran said that starting on March 20th or 21st, I don't have the story right in front of you. It was one of those days, 20th to 21st, that Iran is going to begin trading oil in euros. Now, we've also heard since then, that first came out back in October, we've also heard since then that they may or may not do that on March 20th or 21st, and we'll see. Frankly, I don't think that the United States went to war with Iraq over the euro-dollar thing, and I don't think that we would go to war with Iran over the euro-dollar thing, although it is very troublesome. I think that, you know, frankly, I think that the reason why Bush went to war in Iraq, very simple, Cindy Sheehan laid it out when she testified before Congress. Bush said that he thought it would get him political capital. He thought it would get him, it would get Republicans in control of the Senate in 2002, and it would get him reelected in 2004. That's why he went to war. And the stuff like getting all the oil from Iraq and the dollar, you know, maintaining the dollar as the currency, world currency for oil, those were bonuses. But, you know, he was in 1999, he told his biographer, Mickey Hertzquitz, if he got elected, he was going to invade Iraq because he would get political capital. And then he could use that political capital to undo everything that Roosevelt did, just like Limbaugh said.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I think really that's what it was all about. It was all about political power.
Well, I appreciate your comment, and as a former Republican, and now I'm converted over to Democrat, or should I say whoever that got a halfway decent head on their shoulders, that's who I vote for. Keep up the good work, and I love listening to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. Appreciate it very much. John in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, we've got a little less than a minute left. What's something quick on your mind?
Yeah, this healthcare discussion is something that's very important to me. I've had this talk with many conservatives. I believe in some sort of regulated healthcare system. The fact that we spend 16% of GDP in climbing on healthcare, it's crippling the business, and I'm a business owner. And I'm an advocate of expanding the Medicare system to cover everybody. Economies of scale drive down the cost, mainly because of that administrative cost. The argument I always get back, and maybe, you know, you can talk about this after you come back from the commercial, is they always say that it is the regulation itself that cripples healthcare providers and hospitals and causes the cost to go up in part. Not the only thing, obviously there's a lot of things involved with that, but they say that the regulation itself increases the cost of providing health care.
Well,
then I don't know what to say to that.
Well, the response to that is, I'm sorry, John, if I'm talking to you, let's say you're the conservative. I'm sorry, John, but I don't have the ability to test 20 or 30 drugs to find out if they're safe and if they're effective. I just don't have the ability to do that. So somebody's going to have to do that. I'm going to trust my government to do that because they have no vested interest in whether or not I buy that drug. And so, yeah, regulation does drive up costs, and it protects us. And therefore, in my mind, it's worth the cost. And if a business wants to do business in a regulated environment, they can still make money. They may not make quite as much, but I tell you, the drug companies are making billions. And the hospital companies, Bill Frist's dad, HCA, he's now a multi-billionaire. So they can make money. Thanks a lot for the call, John. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
XM Satellite Radio.
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. FrameShopIsOpen.com. Be sure you put in the isopen.com part, otherwise I think you end up in a dirty picture site or something. Jeffrey, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The message is not the frame. To reframe national security, Democrats have a specific job to do, you say.
That's right. One of the key issues when we talk about framing is to distinguish between the individual sound bites or clips that people use in political campaigns and the broader ideas that are guiding how it is that we talk about the broad issues, what we call the frame. And when it comes to the current debate, the big, big frame is national security. One of the things that I'm advocating is that Democrats need to try to get beyond this idea of the war on terror, simply stepping into what has been a very successful frame for the Republicans, and to push on to something that I call guarding the gates, this notion that we need to think about chasing down al-Qaeda abroad and guarding the gates at home in order to keep the nation safe. And if we do that, we will bring the debate to a new terrain and we can be more confident on all the various issues that cut through national security.
Well, and the advantage of that, I would think, is twofold. First of all, it's not an abstraction. War on terror is an abstraction. So, you know, just like, you know, you say, oh, we're going to fight the war on drugs. We've got to fight the war on poverty. People roll their eyes, right? So war on terror, it's rapidly becoming kind of a vague and meaningless term. And secondly, because guard the gates has both a verb and a specific noun in it, it's possible for people to visualize this. And the visual memory part of our brain is the part, is the most massive part of our brain. We most successfully store memory if we can convert it into a picture first. In fact, you know, there's all these old strategies, all these old tricks to memorize things by converting them into weird pictures. And I think that's a guard the gates. It's just a powerful, powerful frame for those reasons.
Well, that's exactly right for the reasons that you mentioned. One concept that I think about is the notion of grounding our frames. A lot of times, if we allow the broad ideas that we have to be too abstract, then they're not expressed in concrete terms, then people don't grab hold of them. But the idea of a frame also is something that allows us to think about issues and to be much more confident in what we say, even if we don't invoke that concept. So take, for example, what's going on today. With the censure motion that Russ Feingold has brought up on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've got is that Democrats are running scared from that measure, not because they're afraid to stand up and censure the president, but because they're afraid that the Republicans are going to say that they're weak on defense as a result of this. In fact, if you go over to the GOP, GOP.com at their website, it's exactly what they've done. In response to Russ Feingold's measure, the GOP has attacked the Democrats for being weak on defense. And what they've done over at the GOP is they've used the phrase, the tools of defense. It's Ken Melman, the GOP chair, is accusing the Democrats, if they support this censure measure, of weakening the tools that they're using to fight the war on terror. So they've got the GOP attempting to use their frame, the war on terror, in order to make it seem really, really concrete. Of course, a censure measure is not weakening the tools. So if you flip on over to the Democratic website, the Democrat.com, we actually see Howard Dean attempting to use this idea of guarding the gates by talking about the importance of homeland security beginning with hometown security, this idea that while the Republicans are off fighting a war that's weak on defense, but we can't be strong on defense until we see that every port, every airplane gate, and every border crossing is an opportunity to guard the gates. So it's about not running away from that attack, but steering into it, taking control of it, and redirecting it.
It's Aikido. It's using the energy of your opponent against them.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of my favorite books is a book called Verbal Judo, different related sport, though, in which it's the same idea, in which you use that attack in order to redirect your opponent.
Jeffrey Feldman, what other frames do you see out there? We've got about 2 minutes left. We can dig into this a little bit. What other frames do you see emerging? What do you see are the frames? And frankly, I'm also curious your take on what are the frames that the Democrats right now are trying to use with or without competence?
Well, I think that one of the frames that Democrats are trying to use is this notion of good management. We see this coming out of the Mark Warner campaign in particular. This week, there's been a lot of buzz for good reason about Mark Warner. He's very organized. He's got a big machine behind him. And he's garnered some support from some key Netroots bloggers, in particular Jerome Armstrong, one of the brains behind MyDD, a very large and successful blog, has joined Warner's team. And what Warner has done is he's created this Virginia formula, this frame that says, look, it's not about partisan politics, it's about good management. And he's really attempting to say that what the White House needs right now is a really good manager, someone who can mind the books, who can watch the P's and Q's, and can turn the country around.
This is really the competence frame.
It's the competency, exactly. It's really interesting. When Warner is asked about what to do in the war in Iraq, he defers. He says, you know, he's still looking into that, and he tries to get things back onto this management frame. It's really, really interesting to see how far that's going to go with Mark Warner. I personally think that Warner is a very strong candidate if he can locate his inner charisma. He's a little bit lacking in charisma.
I've gotten a few emails and things forwarded to me where people are starting to use the meme of George of the Bungle. Instead of George of the Jungle, George of the Bungle. And, you know, asserting basically that George W. Bush has bungled all this stuff. He's bungled Homeland Security. He's bungled, you know, in fact, he did before 9/11, he bungled Homeland Security.
That's exactly right. And it's the notion of organization, management, competency. It does seem like it's a really interesting idea, and it is slowly taking off.
This is flipping the frame, the competence frame, inside out and applying the reverse of it to the Republicans.
Exactly. And it could be effective. It could be very effective. On the Republican side, I think we're going to hear this phrase, weakening the tools in the war against terror. We're going to hear it 1,000 times this week because the Republicans are still reeling from the impact of the port scandal. They're still desperately trying to reclaim the national security frame on their own, and they're going to do that by the only way that they really know how, which is to attack Democrats for being weak on security. So Democrats, Americans in general, need to be very careful not to fall into that frame, not to allow themselves to be taken over by it.
We have the president having broken the FISA law. He actually broke the law. Russ Feingold points this out, and the Republicans say, "Oh, wait a minute! You're trying to take away our tools. That's how this is going to. That's how this is playing out."
Exactly.
And you think they're going to succeed?
I think that they're going to muddy the waters, and by the end of this week, it's going to be a very confused issue. And the great hope is that Feingold will be able to push things forward to really talk about investigating rather than getting bogged down in this notion of weakness.
Yeah, because this, or on the other hand, as you say, taking the notion of weakness and applying it to the Republicans. Hey, wait a minute, you know, why are you trying to weaken America? Why are you trying to weaken America by breaking our laws? Why are you trying to weaken America by investigating terrorists in a way that if it ever came to trial, you couldn't use the evidence in a court of law because you obtained it illegally?
Exactly.
Yeah, that would work well, I would think. Good one that they should take as well. Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Working two jobs ends never seem to me. She often goes hungry so her babies can't eat. Fatherless son wears torn clothes to school. Making fun of him's the only golden rule. She doesn't know she's a favorite daughter. If someone wants to help her, walk on water. He destroyed.
Welcome back, friends. 21 minutes past the hour. All of our bumper music today, this is an FYI, all of the music you hear coming back from the breaks today comes from the album Homeless in America, which you can find on the web at Freedom Tracks. Freedom, TRACKS.com, freedomtracks.com, the album Homeless in America. And welcome back to the program. Ellen Ratner is with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Ellen.
The new chairman of the Economic Advisors, Edward Lazar, I think that's how he pronounces it, mm-hmm. He wants tax cuts, and he wants them now. And he's trying to meet with the Senate and House, but, of course, the Senate and House are in disagreement about these tax cuts. And so Mr. Bush is not getting his tax cuts. Now, it's also interesting, because, as you know, what's happening with the Bush administration and Congress is the Gallup poll has now put Bush's popularity rating at 36%.
Right, lower than the number, than the percentage of people in the United States who believe that the United States government is negotiating with space aliens.
Right.
I kid you not. 38% of Americans believe that.
Frank Newport, who's head of the Gallup poll, talked about this, and he said that Truman, Johnson, and Nixon also had those low poll numbers in their second terms. Well, Truman didn't have a second term, but he sort of had a second term, not a full second term.
Right.
I mean, he had a full second term, but not a full first term.
Right.
And he said when they get to those numbers, they never recover.
And you know what killed Truman was the Korean War. I mean, that's why that was Roosevelt's, or not Roosevelt, that was Eisenhower's entire campaign thing was, you know, vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. And in fact, I may even have the spot for that. I can play it for you. But it's just and with Johnson, I mean, it was the Vietnam War. Hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?
I remember saying that.
Yeah, me too. so you know, the Republicans who are out there saying, oh, you know, this is no problem. And
remember, Ho Chi Minh, the NLF is going to win.
Yeah, there you go. Here's by the way, this is Dwight D. Eisenhower's campaign. This is the ad that he ran when he was running for president in 1952.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. Can you imagine?
Right.
Today, I was a Republican. Vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. And the Democrats are afraid to say such a thing because they're afraid that, you know, it's going to be McGovern all over again. I mean, when are these guys going to stop being afraid of their shadows?
There's actually an interesting Maureen Dowd column in the New York Times just on that today. Mr. Grassley, Senator Grassley, wants to extend the deadline for late enrollment for Part D Medicare despite the fact the president's going around and saying it's working, it's working.
Yeah, well, what's really bizarre is the president is saying 24 million people have looked at the Medicare program and liked it and decided to sign up. He says that right up front. And yet the fact of the matter is that only about 5 million people have actually signed up on their own. There are 24 million people who have signed up, but the majority of them were signed up automatically because of the insurance programs they were part of.
Exactly.
So he's lying to the American people.
And
once again,
nobody can figure it out still.
Well, the media is apparently not pointing this out.
Today, it's interesting that they are now saying that the United States Army is in very serious situation if our oil supply gets cut off. The United States only has, at our consumption level, 3.4 years of reserves, and of course, worldwide, 41 years.
Oh man, do you recall the whole thing about the Straits of Hormuz?
No.
In World War II. What Franklin Roosevelt did, that conspiracy theorists to this day believe he did intentionally to provoke the Japanese to attack the United States.
Oh, right, in Pearl Harbor.
Right, so he would have a rationale to invade Europe because he wanted to stop Germany. And the Republicans in Congress were, you know, saying we will not go to war against Germany. And so Roosevelt, this is the conspiracy theory, Roosevelt had to have some kind of provocation. And so what he did was he positioned U.S. Warships in the Straits of Hormuz, there between Indonesia and what's the island off the coast? Anyhow, you know, blocked
on the Japanese.
That's right. And that's the line. That's where the oil came from the Middle East through the Straits of Hormuz to get to Japan. So he cut off the supply of oil to Japan. And Japan essentially had no choice. They had to attack us to get us to stop cutting off their oil supply. And it sounds like what you're saying is we are finding ourselves now, or could find ourselves, in the same position the Japanese found.
Exactly. And then our armed services, with only 3.4 years of oil reserves, what kind of situation we'd be in.
Yeah, that is very, very tricky because it's like, you know, a rat is not a particularly dangerous animal until you corner it. And not to say that the United States is a rat. I mean, this is a noble nation, but you don't want any nation, especially your own, to be in that kind of a situation. Thanks, Ellen, for the information.
You're welcome.
Always great talking with you. TalkRadioNews.com, Ellen Ratner's organization at the Talk Radio News Service. 27 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this. The Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no!
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The price of living's bound to keep on going up and up as we begin to dip in Social Security's broken cup. Healthcare costs are rocketing way too high to fall. It seems most folks in Washington don't give a damn at all. The baby boomers, we're the baby boomers, zipping down the freeway, shopping at the mall. Deficits are growing, and lately there's been rumors, there's far too many of us to take care of us all.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, every single day. It is amazing. Sometimes you think that there is nothing that Bill Clinton can't be blamed for. You know, it's like, yeah, well, you know, I mean, kind of common sense would sort of indicate there has to be something he can't be blamed for. But no, in fact, that means it's time for our Rush Alert.
With condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
His guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, I'm a bigot, I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class.
I'm a fat conservative butthead
with a taste of a horse's ass.
And our Rush Alert for the day, yes, believe it or not, guess who's responsible for the death of Slobodan Milosevic.
Speculation is he might have been poisoned by somebody. He even wrote that he thought he was going to be poisoned. Now, how can this possibly be? Who would want to poison such a guy like Slobodan Milosevic? What is interesting about this, and I'm not drawing any conclusions, and I'm not even making any connections, I'm not dot connecting or anything else, but it has been reported that Slobo was considering calling Bill Clinton as a witness. He hadn't made the formal request, but was considering it, and now Slobo is no more.
I'm sorry, I can't stop. It's tragic. What can you say? It's tragic. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And this is truly tragic. Leon in Seattle. Hey, Leon, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Yeah, I was just calling. You know, you're talking to the guy with the frameshop.com or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats are just weak. And of course, the Bush people can get away with accusing them of being weak on national security and everything else. But because the Democrats, case, I mean, this week, weakness of the week, Russ Feingold takes a courageous stand. What do the Democrats do? They turn tail and run. And until they, you know, until we get rid of some of these weak Democrats, I think that we're...
Here's the problem that I have. Here's the problem that I have, Leon, with the meme that you're following. And it's one that the mainstream media is promoting very aggressively. Russ Feingold, first of all, think back to when Jack Murtha came out and said, we're going down the wrong road in Iraq and it's time to change course. Immediately, the Republicans in the House of Representatives put together, I mean, as soon as Murtha got up and gave his speech, within 2 hours, they put together a resolution that said, be it resolved that the United States shall pull out of Iraq within 24 hours and leave behind all equipment and everything. Now, that's not what Murtha was suggesting. He was talking about a strategic redeployment around the perimeter, take you know, months, maybe as much as a year. He had a very careful and well thought out plan. But the Republicans came with this resolution, and the media all said it was the Murtha resolution. The Republicans said it was the Murtha resolution. And of course, even Jack Murtha voted against it. All the Democrats voted against it, all the Republicans voted against it,
right.
And it looked like Jack Murtha got smeared. So keeping that in mind, how the Republicans play this extraordinarily slimy game. Russ Feingold comes to the floor yesterday, and he says, "I'm putting forward this, you know, this censure, and we need to have hearings on this. We need to have a discussion about this. We need to bring in witnesses and swear them under oath and ask them serious questions and find out if, in fact, a crime has been committed, as it appears that there has been." And immediately, Bill Frist says, "Let's pull a vote on this thing." And Russ Feingold is saying, "No, we don't want to vote on it. We want a discussion of it." So, which is the right thing to do and the right thing to say. And so they go to other Democrats and say, "Are you going to vote on this thing to support Russ Feingold?" And they're going, "Well, he hasn't called for a vote." I mean, I interviewed Ron Wyden yesterday morning. I said, "You know, are you going to support Russ Feingold?" And he said, "Well, if you're asking if I'm going to vote for it, there's nothing there. He hasn't asked for a vote yet. This thing needs to be investigated." And Ron Wyden said, "And we need to investigate it." So the reality is that the Democrats are actually standing very firm against this thing. They're standing up to the President of the United States and doing so in a rather aggressive fashion. But the media is spinning it using the RNC talking points.
Hmm.
Yeah. And see, it got you. It got me
so
yesterday.
One of the reasons it works is because there's so many. How many Democrats voted for the bankruptcy bill? How many Democrats voted for the war in Iraq?
I know, and for CAFTA, I am absolutely right there with you, Dick. Well, actually, Leon, did you know that a majority of the Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against the war in Iraq?
Oh yeah, I know that.
But I'll bet most Americans don't know that.
Yeah, no, and enough, but enough Democrats voted for it, and particularly in the Senate. I mean, you know, here the guy that's going to be carrying the standard, John Kerry, voted for it.
Right. Yeah, and it only took a few.
It's an albatross around Democrats' neck. I mean, I think that when you think long term on this, is that when we came out of 9/11, I think Democrats should have taken a deep breath and figured out these people, we know them, and this is the trajectory things are going to go for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And what are we going to do about it? And,
yeah.
You know, that's, you know.
Good point. Good point, Leon, and it needs to be pointed out over and over. I appreciate the call, and thank you for making it. By the way, just as an update, Senator Lincoln Chafee, the Republican from Rhode Island, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island offered some praise for Feingold, saying the resolution would be positive if it fueled debate over the legality of some policies in the war on terrorism. Democrats, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, quote, "The president broke the law, and he needs to be held accountable. Talk about high crimes and misdemeanors." Harkin went on to say that he will vote for the Feingold resolution if it comes up. So here you've got Tom Harkin saying, "Yes, I'll vote for the resolution," and you've got the Republican Lincoln Chafee saying, "We need to investigate this. This could be the Waterloo for the Bush administration. This could be it. I mean, this could be the turning point, the point at which, well, as Russ Feingold said yesterday, it just becomes clear, absolutely clear."
Now, the facts are pretty straightforward. Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, nearly 30 years ago to ensure that as we wiretap suspected terrorists and spies, we also protect innocent Americans from unjustified government intrusion. Mr. President, FISA makes it a crime, to wiretap Americans on U.S. soil without the requisite warrants, and the president has ordered warrantless wiretaps of Americans on U.S. soil. So it's pretty simple. The president has broken that law, and that alone is unacceptable.
Yeah, very straightforward. He broke the law. Let's look into this thing. I mean, this is not rocket science. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to call in. Yesterday, I was doing a little radio channel surfing, and I came across this Christian radio station where they were interviewing somebody about the IDEA Act. I don't know if you know or you're familiar with that.
Yeah, if you're talking about is the same one I'm familiar with. It's a school.
Yeah, it's Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
Right.
Basically,
yeah.
It was passed in the early 70s, and
yeah. And what it says basically is that if a child is learning disabled, then the school is required by law, if they want to continue getting federal funds. They can opt out of it if they opt out of federal funds. But if they want to continue getting federal funds, they must provide an appropriate education to that child, which is very expensive for school districts that have a lot of special ed kids.
Yeah. And basically, I benefit from it because my daughter is autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And she receives speech therapy and occupational therapy. What really alarmed me, though, is that Ashcroft was telling this story about some kid that, you know, didn't specify where it happened. He basically just says, well, this young man was involved in the bringing of a 357 onto campus, and apparently the school tried to discipline him along with six others, and because of his being tagged learning disabled, he apparently got out of being punished. But, I mean, like I said, it was very vague.
That's not possible, Sean. I'm president of the board of directors of a school for learning disabled kids in New Hampshire. It's called the Hunter School, hunterschool.org, if you want to check it out. And you know, I mean, this is all we deal with, are these kids and these laws. And that's nonsense. There is no law that would protect a child who brought a 357 to school.
Well, that's kind
period.
Of what my wife's a teacher, and she said, yeah, they have to consider things before they discipline a child, but it's not impossible to discipline them. And
right.
I just saw it as, once again, I mean, here it is, the Christian right really isn't about doing for society. It's about cutting taxes. It's about removing the programs that are ultimately going to put more bucks in their pocket.
Yeah.
And
what
it's
sort of like seeing ancient Rome all over again, where you have the state religion and the priests of the religion are the promoters of the state, and the promoters of state power are the promoters of the religion. And in the process, the state gets usurped and the religion gets twisted.
I know. And I'm a Christian myself, and it really, you know, hit home, because I just heard them talking about the IDEA Act and thought, oh, this might be something I want to hear.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking myself going, this is just obscene that, you know, these people, you know, are targeting something. I mean, it's one thing if they say, oh, there has to be revisions, or there has to be some sort of, like...
Or a better funding mechanism, frankly, is what I would be in favor of. Sean, we got to take a break here, but I appreciate your calling and bringing it up. You make a very good point, and a lot of disinformation on the Reich. An enormous amount. And we just have to be alert to it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
People who ride the daily train, they all try so hard to keep food on the table and the grass mowed in the yard. They believe in God and country, their religion too. Try and do the best they can, somehow fit into the plan. But we sing Amazing Grace by the river's end.
And welcome back, my friends. Songs about the homeless. The album Homeless in America, freedomtracks.com. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to go back to that guy from, what was it, CNS News?
Right.
Is that it? And he's talking about the liberal media.
Mm-hmm.
Just one example of that, the standard bearer of the supposed liberal media, the New York Times. Basically, they are, in my opinion, somewhat responsible for the Iraq War, for publishing repeated, unsubstantiated stories.
Yeah, and Judith Miller specifically, by the way.
Right, Judith Miller, and then also they chose to sit on the illegal wiretap story for over a year. When they actually got it more than a month before the election. So in my opinion, they are somewhat responsible for this fascist being reelected.
I won't disagree with you at all, John.
The one, and And one other thing, as far as the Democratic Party goes, in my opinion, and it's not totally co-opted, but I think the extreme right wing of the Republican Party has been infiltrating the Democratic Party since at least back in the Nixon era.
Oh yeah. Well, it's entirely possible. I tend to think of a more benign explanation, and that is that a lot of this started with the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, under Bill Clinton. He created that. And sure. He was looking around. He was going to run for president against, you know, a fairly powerful guy, George Bush Sr., who had a lot of money and a lot of corporations on his side. And he looks around and he says, you know, the labor unions used to be 25% of the American workforce when Reagan came into power. It was 35% of the American workforce when John Kennedy was elected. And it's down to 7-8% now. I can't go to the labor unions and get enough money to run an election. Where am I going to get a large check? And, well, let's see, if I push NAFTA and GATT, the big multinational corporations will support me. And so he created the DLC. And you got all these Democrats who are, you know, sucking on that particular money source. And, you know, tragically, and they have not, I won't say taken over the Democratic Party, but they have very, very, very substantial force in the Democratic Party. Ron Emanuel and all these other guys who are, you know, Evan Bayh, Joe Biden, Lieberman, all the DLC Democrats. And it's just, you know, that's the shame in my mind. So.
Right. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact is that if you look at what Bush has done, from the very beginning, from his obsession with secrecy, from his accusing every political opponent of being unpatriotic or treasonous, his utilization of fear to erode individual rights and the rule of law to justify preemptive war and torture.
Right.
Who is that? Was that Benito Mussolini?
No, I'd say in my opinion, it's Joe Stalin. I think that what we're seeing is Joe Stalin reincarnated, and it's a scary, scary thing. Blaine and I'll one of these days remind me. I'll tell you my Khrushchev story. Blaine in that I learned when I was in Russia. Blaine in Sacramento, California. Hey, Blaine, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. This guy you had on the program really struck a chord with everyone today, it seems.
Yeah.
I just want to make a couple of comments about that. I remember in the 70s when the hearings, Nixon impeachment hearings were going on.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a child then, but I remember my mom watching that on TV, and we couldn't have gotten more than three channels in the 70s.
Yep.
So that was on mainstream media, right?
Yep. I mean, it was carried live throughout the day by at least one of the networks, certainly, because I remember watching it too, and I was a teenager at the time.
Yeah, okay, so that was live. So the other day, you know, I have to watch C-SPAN to see Feingold. But it's
right.
Way up on channel 96 or 95 now here in Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I don't think is right, because now you have to have expanded basic cable in order to get it. So
and C-SPAN is not even part of your basic cable package?
No, it's not anymore. They changed it. It used to be on channel 28 and 29, which was the cutoff
right.
for the other channels kicking in.
Oh, that's incredible, because C-SPAN was created.
Is that legal?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, it shouldn't be anyway. It's part of the whole deal was that when the cable company said, "Listen, we want to use the public rights of way. We want to use the public telephone
right.
poles. We want to use the public roads. We want the Department of Roads to maintain these things." The communities said, "Okay, you can use the public rights of way. You can use the commons, but you got to pay back a little bit, and you got to kick into this fund that's going to create a national kind of town hall network, which is C-SPAN, which will serve the public good." And that was the trade-out that the cable companies got in exchange for monopolies.
Right, and that puzzles me. Now, we haven't ever, you know, discontinued expanded service to see if 96 and 95 channels would come in.
Yeah,
but
it may
it's
just
funny that they hide it way up there. But my point being that it's not on the mainstream media. And, okay, the other thing was in the B. It was on in the afternoon on Monday, right?
Yeah.
Feingold. The next day in the paper, of course, there's no way what they should have had was front page news, right? Since
mm-hmm.
Bush introduced, because that was very powerful.
Right, with the specific charges.
Yes, he was very specific, it was a very to-the-point speech. Anyway, they have it buried in the A section, and the title is Censure Bush Effort Falters, as though it's a response to another article they had. Do you see
right.
what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying, Blaine, and it's just wrong. It's wrong the way the media has been reporting on this. It's wrong the fact that the media has not been quoting Russ Feingold, has not been pointing out what he said. It is just wrong. I mean, you know, Russ Feingold was very explicit.
But the president did much more than that. Not only did the president break the law, he also actively misled Congress and the American people about his actions. And then...
And it's obvious, just lays it right out. It didn't make the papers. Amazing. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they did it. The Republicans in the Senate, they shot themselves in the foot. Of course, it's not being played that way in the media. And I frankly can't figure out why not, but they did. And I'll tell you, I am not making this up.
Not making this up.
No, definitely. We're not making this up. The Senate Republicans on Tuesday narrowly defeated an effort to impose budget rules on themselves. This is Carl Hulse's piece in the New York Times. The Senate rejected on a 50-50 tie a proposal to restore what are known as pay-go rules. Now, these pay-go rules were originally put into place by Republicans. And the whole idea was, we got to control these spendthrift Democrats, right? This was the Republican idea. So if you pass a law that says, for example, that you're going to spend an extra $1 billion, you've got to pass a $1 billion tax increase. If you pass a law that says that you're going to cut $1 billion, you've got to cut taxes by $1 billion, whatever it is. You know, the budget has to be in balance. And as Kent Conrad, the senator from North Dakota, said on the senior Democrat on the budget committee, he said, for those who are fiscally responsible, here's your chance. You are going to be able to prove with one vote whether you're serious about doing something about these runaway debts and runaway deficits or whether it is all talk. And I tell you, my friends,
I'm not making this up.
I definitely am not making this up. It's just the Senate voted 50-50. And did Dick Cheney come in and break the vote? Did he? No. Gee. Dick Cheney and George Bush, no, because they wanted this to go down in flames, even though there were Republicans voting for it. Five Republicans joined 44 Democrats and one independent. That would be Jim Jeffords in supporting this. Only 44 Democrats. Five Republicans. Did Dick Cheney show up? No. There was another 50-50 vote, by the way. Senate defeated an effort to add $6.3 billion for student aid and work-study programs. And this was one that was actually a pay-go proposal. This actually, they're going to fund student aid and work-study programs and pay for it by cracking down on a particular corporate tax loophole. Cracking down on corporations that are exploiting this loophole, and we know that they're sucking about $6.5 billion a year out of the economy. And so let's crack down on that loophole and take that $6.5 billion and give it to student aid and work-study programs. And I kid you not.
I'm not making this up.
Definitely am not. The Republicans said nope. Now, out of the other side of their mouths, they will tell you, well, you know, the reason why we can't compete with India and China is because we don't have an educated workforce. You've heard it from all the cons. You hear it from Tom Friedman. You hear it from everybody in this administration. Well, we got to have a more educated workforce. We need more No Child Left Behind. We need to give more money to those big testing companies like Marvin Bush owns. Don't you know? Well, it ain't working. It ain't working. And 50-50. 100 people in the Senate, of course. And a tie vote loses, by the way, in the Senate. Not like blackjack. Actually, a tie in blackjack loses, too, doesn't it? I think. Anyway, so that's the situation. And now the Bush administration's coming forward and saying, we want $91 billion, by the way. Off budget. We would like an additional $91 billion. Now, this is making the rest of the world very, very skittery. This from MarketWatch, New York, just 2 hours ago. The dollar weakened against its major rivals Wednesday, hitting a fresh one-week low versus the euro. After a Treasury report showed capital inflows failed to cover the record trade deficit of the corresponding month. Trade deficit rose 5.3% to a new record of $68.5 billion for this month. $68.5 billion, our trade deficit. As Michael Wolfuck, the senior currency strategist at the Bank of New York, pointed out, this is the second consecutive month that we haven't been able to quite sell enough Treasury bills to cover this. He said this can no longer be viewed as a one-off event associated with year-end. Japanese holdings of U.S. Treasuries fell in January, while Chinese holdings rose. As Ashraf Ladi, the chief currency analyst at MG Financial Group, said, this number is not a good one for the dollar. He said this is the second month in a row that capital flows are lower than the deficit. He said there's increased difficulty for the U.S. to finance its swelling trade deficit. Do you get it? We are buying stuff from the rest of the world because we have large corporations who lobbied aggressively to get NAFTA and GATT and the WTO and CAFTA and get all these rules, all the trade rules changed, get all the tariffs thrown out so that a corporation can bring in goods from anywhere in the world and not have to pay a duty on it, so that they really can have Chinese slave labor competing with union labor in Peoria, Illinois. And, of course, guess who's going to win that competition when the judge is the multinational corporation that writes the paycheck? And as a consequence of this, all this cheap junk from all over the world, it's not cheap junk. A lot of it's actually very good stuff, but it's made with cheap labor all over the world. It's coming to the United States cheap. And what is the consequence of this? There's two consequences of this. Number one, it inflates the profits of big corporations in the United States. The largest corporation in the world, Walmart. Huge profits as a result of the trade policies that were promoted by Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush. Huge profits. So we see retailers who are able to, and manufacturers who are able to bring in cheap stuff from overseas, and then, you know, like Dell assemble it down in Texas, or like Walmart sell it right out the front door. They're very profitable. But what about the jobs? The jobs are gone. And this, in my opinion, is a result of the failure of a political system that should be responsive to we the people, but instead is responsive to the corporations. And why? Well, because we no longer have laws like this old Wisconsin law. This is a law that Wisconsin had on the books in the 1900s. It goes back to the late 1700s. Well, Wisconsin wasn't a state in the late 1700s. It goes back to the 1800s and in the early 1900s. Right up to, I believe this was actually pulled off the books in 1954, which was kind of an anomaly. Nobody noticed it was there. Most of these laws got pulled off the books at the latest in the 1920s. So these are laws mostly from the 19th century, the 1800s. This Wisconsin law, the title Political Corporations Contributions by Corporations. No corporation doing business in this state. Now, by the way, these are the laws we need back. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute or offer, consent, or agree to pay or contribute directly or indirectly any money, property, free service of its officers or employees or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. That's pretty unambiguous. Penalty. Any officer, employee, agent, or attorney or other representative of any corporation acting for and in behalf of such corporation who shall violate this act shall be punished upon conviction by a fine of not less than $100 nor more than $5,000. Keep in mind, this goes back to the days when that was an awful lot of money. Or by imprisonment in the state prison for a period of not less than 1 nor more than 5 years, or by both. Such fine and imprisonment in the discretion of the court or judge before whom such conviction is had, and if the corporation shall be subject to a penalty, then by forfeiture in double the amount of any fine, and if a domestic corporation, it shall be dissolved. If after a proper proceeding upon quo warranto in either the circuit or supreme court of the state to be prosecuted by the attorney general of the state, the court shall find and give judgment that section 1 of this act has been violated as charged, and if a foreigner non-resident agent, its right to do business in the state shall be declared forfeited. Now, this is pretty straightforward. There's no secret language here. This isn't like the Patriot Act where it says, see previous law, page 3. But, no, this is just very straightforward. It is illegal for corporations to participate in politics. Well, why would the founders say that? Why would the framers say that? Why would, throughout the 19th century, throughout the 1800s in the United States, why would virtually every state in the Union have a law that says that? Because they understood. They understood that corporations don't breathe, don't eat, don't worry about the fresh air, don't worry about fresh water, don't vote. So, and they say, hey, they're not persons, they can't vote. What are they doing in our politics? Now, individuals can, you know, speak on behalf of a corporation if they want, but they've got to be doing it as an individual. Or they can't actually speak on behalf of a corporation. They can speak on behalf of the goals. But all this stuff has been thrown out the window. And what has it brought us? It's brought us to the brink of an economic disaster. And America is waking up to this now, my friends. And these so-called conservatives among the Democrats and the so-called conservatives among the Republicans, big price to pay. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Slow train coming down that freedom track. Slow train coming on down that freedom track. Don't need money in your sack, fancy suit on your back. Ride the slow train.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman radio program, where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active. 21 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Eatonville, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Jeff.
Yes, last night at 10:15, Laura Flanders reported something I'd never heard. Last Friday, there was an oil spill in Alaska. 250,000 gallons of oil spilled, possibly bigger than the Exxon Valdez.
No, not bigger. The Exxon, Jeff, hang on just a second. The Exxon Valdez was 11 million. This is much smaller than that. This is, however, the largest spill ever on the North Slope. We talked about it actually on the program last week. It happened. It's been going on for about a week up there. They're having a real problem shutting it down apparently because it's so cold up there. By the way, we're live on KUDO in Alaska in Anchorage right now. Maybe somebody from Anchorage will call in and give us an update on what they, you know, their take on it. But so far, it looks like a terrible oil spill for the North Slope. And in my opinion, it's not being reported by the mainstream media because it might raise questions about whether we should be drilling in Anwar, for example. But,
yeah,
you know, who knows?
You're right. Well, thanks for reporting it, and I wanted to get it out to everybody. Apparently, you already did.
Yeah.
You're awesome, Tom. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jeff. And it's one of those kind of things that's worth repeating. I appreciate it. John in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, from one coast to the other. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call. I believe that you're going to see in the coming months this notion of the liberal media having undermined the war in Iraq being given a full court press.
They've got to blame somebody.
By the Republican noise machine. It's already begun. Certainly they had this talking point all along that not enough coverage was being given to positive news coming out of that region. But I think as they see, I think they're becoming convinced that Iraq is going to slip away and descend into civil war. And I think they're preparing for that by really trying to permeate the news media with this idea.
I don't disagree with you. In fact, I think that's probably one of the reasons why we, along with hundreds of other talk shows across the United States, got offered an opportunity to have a guest on to talk about the liberal media.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's being advanced by the very influential right wing blog Powerline. Recently, President Bush recently in his most recent speech talked about how the terrorists are losing on the battlefield, but winning through the use of images on television. Mm-hmm. They're not going to blame themselves.
No, No, they absolutely not. Bush has never taken blame for anything in his whole entire life.
So they're really gonna, like I said, it's gonna be an all out effort to set up this fall guy. You know, this amorphous concept of the liberal media, or I guess in their eyes, the treasonous media, as having been responsible for the defeat of their goals in Iraq.
Right, and the question is going to be: is the media going to stand for it or not? We'll see.
We'll see.
John, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
It's an interesting point. Bush is just going to play this just like he has in the past.
You've shown a remarkable spirit of candor in the last couple of weeks in your conversations, speeches about Iraq, and I'm wondering if in that spirit I might ask you a question that you didn't seem to have an answer for the last time you were asked, and that is, what would you say is the biggest mistake you've made during your presidency, and what have you learned from it?
Answering Dickerson's question. The last time those questions were asked, I really felt like it was an attempt for me to say it was a mistake to go into Iraq. And it wasn't a mistake to go into Iraq. It was the right decision to make. I think that, John, there's going to be a lot of analysis done on the decisions on the ground in Iraq. For example, I'm fully aware that some have said it was a mistake not to put enough troops there immediately. Are more troops. I made my decision based upon the recommendations of Tommy Frank, and I still think it was the right decision to make. But history will judge. I said the other day that a mistake was trying to train a civilian defense force in an Iraqi army at the same time, but not giving the civilian defense force enough training and tools necessary to be able to battle a group of thugs and killers. And so we adjusted. And the point I'm trying to make to the American people in this, as you said, candid dialogue, I hope I've been candid all along, but the candid dialogue is to say we're constantly changing our tactics to meet the changing tactics of an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important for our citizens to understand. Thank you.
In other words, mistakes? Me? It's sort of a variation on the old, what me worry, Alfred E. Newman. Quid me anxious sum in Latin, today the Ides of March, the day that Caesar was reputedly stabbed by Brutus. So as Alfred E. Newman used to say famously, quid me anxious sum, what me worry?
I'm not making this up.
Yeah, no, I'm not. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls. And I want to get back, also drill down into some of these economic issues that we're facing right now, because this is what's really driving the right-wing agenda, and this is our future. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If it's true the Second Amendment guarantees unlimited arms, why not build a chemical factory inside your neighbor's farm? Be first in your neighborhood to command a Sherman tank. Down to school, drop the kids off or head into the bank. Arm your pilot Learjet and bomb the NRA. If they can have machine guns, we can have napalm spray. Upgrade your TV satellite with a laser up in space. And blast old Smith and Wesson right out of the human race.
And welcome back, my friends. That from the album Homeless in America from freedomtracks.com, 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, quoting from an FBI report, holds daily leaflet distribution activities in downtown Pittsburgh and is currently focused on its opposition to the potential war in Iraq. According to these leaflets, Iraq does not possess weapons of mass destruction. You get this? Thomas Merton, one of my heroes. His writings on Catholicism and Zen, his writings on Thomas Merton, just a brilliant, brilliant man. Now passed away. And the center named after him which, frankly, I don't know anything about. I mean, I've read several of Thomas Merton's books, but I don't know anything about the senator that's named after him, other than that sort of pacifist work. The guy was a true mystic. The Thomas Merton Center holds daily leaflet distribution activities in downtown Pittsburgh and is currently... The FBI has been forced to release this. The ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act. And so that found out that the FBI has been looking into the Thomas Merton Center and other groups as potential international terrorism matters. I mean, this is frankly tragic. Jim Kleiser, I believe it is, the Thomas Merton Center director, said the documents say they were conducting some sort of investigation. That implies we were under surveillance simply because we were against the war. Our freedoms are being undermined. Now, the FBI says the FBI agent who photographed the pamphlet distribution was acting with all appropriate investigative authorities and destroyed the pictures when it was determined that they were of no value to the probe. Yeah. February 26, 2003 report was a draft document, was never made part of the official file, he said. So, anyway, it got me off track. I was talking about, but I just, you know, it's, well, which I believe is up for sale. In any case, the U.S. manufacturing section here from today's Wall Street Journal, Timothy Apple. The U.S. manufacturing sector is being reshaped by a low birth rate. Now, are they talking about the birth rate of people? No. It's a low birth rate among factories. Number of factories in the U.S. shrank last year to 336,000, down 10% from its 1997 peak, part of a steady decline that shows no sign of reversing. In Virginia, he says, the death rate in manufacturing isn't any higher than it's been before. What's really changed is that the creation of new factories has dropped so dramatically. Well, you'll recall, I mean, you know, Bush's whole shtick was, you know, if you just give tax breaks to billionaires, then they're going to use that money to build factories, right?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Yeah, well, even giving the multinational corporations in the United States $550,000 per job still didn't work. The rate of factory openings was 3.8% in the third quarter of 92 and stayed above 3% for much of the rest of that decade. Now, keep in mind, this is the 1990s. And, in fact, if you go, I mean, you go all the way back to the 40s, it's been way above this. But in 1998, the rate began falling. Now, why would it be 1998? See, all things do not begin and end with George W. Bush. This is right after Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT. And American corporations were looking around going, hey, used to be we had to pay tariffs when we imported stuff from overseas so that labor in the United States could compete on a level playing field, relatively speaking, with labor overseas. So that if you had labor here that was, you know, it cost $10, $12 an hour, $15 and $20 an hour to make something, and over there you can make the same thing for $1 an hour or $2 an hour, that, or 20 cents an hour, that we're going to impose a tariff, an import tariff that's going to take some of that labor cost and build it into the product, essentially, so that the product is going to cost the same whether it's made in Malaysia, whether it's made in the United States, once it gets on our shores. Therefore, the manufacturers in the United States will have no incentive to go overseas. Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT in 97 or 98, as I recall. Maybe it was 96. In any case, it was right around then. And in 1998, sure enough, the rate of birthing new factories in the United States began falling, hit 2.4% in the first quarter of 2005. It's been steadily falling ever since, well, basically ever since Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT. Closings, meanwhile, have hovered around 3.5% for much of that period. So if you're losing factories at the rate of 3.5% a year, and you're only creating new ones at the rate of 2.4% per year, you got a problem. And it's not just jobs. As Timothy Apple points out in the Wall Street Journal today, new factories not only create jobs, they also use cutting-edge technology, making themselves crucial to the nation's competitiveness. They're also vital to U.S. defense industries, with many of the most advanced components and electronics made at newer facilities. The economists point, here's the irony. Actually, what they should be doing is they should be pointing at Tom Friedman. Economists point to growing import competition and an exodus of U.S. production work to low-cost countries as reasons for the birth rate slump. Period. End of sentence. And proof? One indication is the ballooning U.S. trade deficit, which hit another record in January. In other words, we are importing stuff rather than making stuff here. There are, however, some factories that are being built here. Some are being exported. For example, Lazy Boy, Monroe, Michigan, when 2001 felt the importers bite, inexpensive wooden furniture from China began pouring into the U.S. market. In response, the company closed 20 U.S. factories, outsourced most of its wood furniture production to China. But, as I said, there are some things still being made in the United States. Owings, Illinois, for example, of Toledo, Ohio. $120 million into a Colorado factory. Isn't that great? They built a factory in Colorado. Produces a billion beer bottles a year. So, you know, the death and destruction of American industry, yeah, we can deal with that. Drink more beer! It solves the problem. Very straightforward price. In the meantime, Ben Bernanke, here we've got the Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, telling Congress he's quite concerned about federal budget deficits, urging lawmakers to act soon to bring down these deficits. He said he did suggest that Congress can't ignore the tax side of the budget. Whoa. Now, keep in mind, this is very different from the song that Bernanke was singing just 6 months ago when he was chairman of the Bush Administration Council of Economic Advisors. And he was saying, oh, no, you don't need new taxes. Now he says, and I quote, over time, either taxes will have to be raised or the spending increases embedded in current laws will need to be scaled back or some combination of the two. He went on to say the prospective increase in the budget deficit, which is now $7 and change trillion, and is pushing in the direction of $8 trillion. He said the prospective increase in the budget deficit will place at risk future living standards in our country. Place at risk future living standards in our country. The budget deficit that just George W. Bush has ran up, just the part that George Bush has run up since he became president, last 5 years, $3 trillion. We handed him a credit card. He ran up a $3 trillion bill on it. What could we have done with that $3 trillion that George W. Bush has borrowed from the rest of the world instead of the things that he's done with it? Well, for example, we could have put 398 million children through a year of Head Start. Now, there's not that many children in the United States, but just for a sense of proportion. People say, well, what's $3 trillion? $3 trillion is enough to immunize, to provide health insurance to 1,799 million children for 1 year. 1,700,000 children. That's more than the population of India. It's more than the population of China. We could have insured 1.7 billion children. It's probably about the population of all children on the planet for a year. We could have hired 52,088,418 public school teachers for a year here in the United States with that $3 trillion that George Bush has borrowed in your name and mine that we're going to have to pay back. Since he became president, we could have paid for 145,707,715 students to go for full 4-year scholarships at public universities. Full 4-year scholarships for 145,707,000 students with the $3 trillion that George W. Bush has borrowed since he became president. We could have built 27,063,131 homes, low-income housing units, or any income housing units. We could have built 27 million homes with the money that George W. Bush has borrowed since he became president. We could have fully funded anti-hunger efforts all over the planet. We could have fed everybody on Earth for 121 years, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Seems again of late, in a land divided by hate, some pick up a sign and
summer gun in answer to the call. Headed off to war, what for? No one is really sure. Seems like no one sees the writing on the wall.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. USA Today, a feature story right on the, I believe it's on the front page here. Historic growth historic in federal aid rolls. Social programs show 17% rise over 5 years. Now, the subtext to this is, oh my God, we're becoming a welfare state. What they don't point out is that this is the natural consequence of replacing General Motors as the largest employer in the United States with Walmart as the largest employer in the United States. I mean, just consider this. What we're seeing is an explosion of poverty across the United States, and it's not among people who are not working. It's among people who are working. We're seeing an explosion in the working poor. So enrollment in 25 federal aid programs is up 17%. A sweeping expansion, this is Dennis Caution's article in USA Today, a sweeping expansion of social programs since 2000 has sparked a record increase in the number of Americans receiving federal government benefits such as college aid, food stamps, and health care. Spending on these social programs was $1.3 trillion in 2005, up an inflation-adjusted 22% since 2000. The biggest expansion, Medicaid, the health care program for the poor, added 18 million beneficiaries to become the nation's largest entitlement program. Now, Medicaid, the program for the poor, is the program that is most heavily used by people who work at low-wage employers. They're not making, they don't have a job that provides them with health benefits. They're not making enough money to buy their health insurance. They're not making enough money, in many cases, to even buy food. I mean, they're just barely getting by, and so they become eligible for Medicaid. 18 million additional beneficiaries in the last 5 years. This is the Bush economy. Well, in fact, they just lay it out. Robert Greenstein, head of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, head of the Liberal Center for Budget and Policy. Come on! This is, well, in any case, he says the growth in the number of people in many programs is due to a rise in the poverty rate from 11.3% in 2000 to 12.7% in 2004. Representative Gil Krichnick, a conservative Republican from Minnesota, says the number of people in such programs should not be growing when unemployment is near a record low. Now, this is where Republicans just can't figure this stuff out. They're just totally baffled. The Republicans, they you know, like, well, I don't know what's going on. It doesn't make any sense. Unemployment's going down, and yet more people are taking Medicare. Why? Medicaid, why? He says the food stamp program just grows and grows and grows. It's probably time to revisit food stamps. Well, so the Republican cure, kill the food stamp program. Yeah. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Judy in San Francisco. Hey, Judy, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, Judy. How about you?
I'm getting better, too, but right now I'm pretty scared. When I heard Senator Wayne Allard accuse Senator Feingold of time and time siding with a terrorist.
I know. It was sick demagoguery.
Well, this is what elicits the energy of vigilantism.
Yes.
And this is what I am so afraid of, because of our, everywhere we turn, we just hear, you know, these Republicans trying to elicit hatred and anger against the progressives.
That's because that's all they have.
Yeah.
That's all they have, Judy. They do not have any program to put on the table. Mm-hmm. All they have is, you know, more tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and more bucks for themselves.
Yeah. Well, it seems that the more they're threatened now, because more and more people are turning against them, the wilder their accusations are getting.
Yeah. Expect it to get even more intense as time goes on, Judy. Because, you know, it's like they're you know, I used this metaphor before when talking to Ellen, but it's far more appropriate to the Republican Party than anything else right now. And that is how dangerous a rat gets when it's backed into a corner. It's not a good thing. Definitely not a good thing. Judy, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today? Yep. Hey, if you can punch up line six there, Alex, we'll take Larry on.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Larry.
Yeah, it was interesting that at the break there that Earthwatch Radio had a report on preparing for post-peak oil, and you used the word drilling right before the half-hour break, and I just read an article in Yahoo News about the Mexicans finding discovering a new oil field that they anticipate will produce a 10 billion barrels,
yeah,
which I believe is about 25 times more than what they anticipate in Anwar. So it looks like peak oil may get pushed off at least a year or two.
Yeah, but not much more than a year or two. And,
right.
You know, odds are it'll probably get pushed back when all is said and done after, you know, there's a lot of exploration going on, although they've really done a fairly good job of, you know, hyper-mapping the planet, you know, exploring it from outer space and X-rays and everything else. It'll probably get pushed back a year or two or three. But still, the idea that we would fuel an entire civilization on basically like the bones of dinosaurs, you know, on fossils. I mean, obviously, these are fossils that are older than the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs died out 90 million years ago, started around 300 million years ago. This is from 200 to 300 million years ago. I mean, we're talking a long, long time ago, the plant material that made our fossil fuels. It's just crazy. It's just crazy. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. We got to wrap it up here. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Dr. Peter Tanz of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. He's going to be with us. I'll be asking, have we reached a tipping point with global warming that's triggering a cascading reaction, spinning out of control? In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Lamar Waldron will be here for Sunshine Week about government secrecy, an issue you won't want to miss. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, Viagra for your brain. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.